This recording accompanies the Language B Higher Level Examination, Paper 2, Listening Comprehension, for English, November 2023.
Cet enregistrement accompagne l'examen de Langue B, Niveau supérieur, Épreuve 2, Compréhension orale d'anglais, novembre 2023.
Esta grabación acompaña el examen de lengua B, nivel superior, prueba 2, comprensión auditiva, de inglés, noviembre 2023.
The start and end of each audio text will be indicated by this sound.
Le début et la fin de chaque texte audio seront indiqués par ce son.
El inicio y el final de cada texto de audio se indicarán con este sonido.
The end of the examination will be indicated by this sound.
La fin de l'examen sera indiquée par ce son.
El final del examen se indicará con este sonido.
Text A. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a conversation between two university students, Jenny and Richard, about their views on laws.
Hi, Jenny. Wow, lots of notes right there.
Yeah, I'm preparing for a speech, but I'm still brainstorming for ideas.
Let's see. What's the topic? Maybe I can help.
That would be great. The topic is still not final, but I'm thinking about laws and if they are necessary at all.
Interesting. But we need laws, Jenny, to set boundaries. Don't you think so?
Well, yes and no. We do need laws for complex matters, but humans shouldn't need laws for things that are common sense. That's what makes us human.
Nah. I think you're overestimating what humans can control using logic. We need laws for all matters. This is what makes us civilized.
If that is true, why hasn't the law stopped robberies? So laws on simple things would just be useless.
Well, laws for simple things would work as pointers for behavior. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong is that once there's a law for something silly, it's bound to be broken.
There's some truth in what you're saying, actually. Some people are tempted to do bizarre things just to break the law. Oh, hang on a minute. Let me check this message.
I think I'm going to be on your side, Richard. We do need laws for some people's behavior, like to stop you from checking your phone messages during a conversation.
Sorry. Back to your speech. I think humans need pointers. Think of something as silly as chewing gum. Do people know the mess it causes?
Sure they do.
Of course they do, but there's gum all over the place. So would you say we need a law to stop this?
Are you kidding? Is that even possible? I mean, would a law really make a difference?
Oh, yes. In Singapore, there was a ban on chewing gum for over 30 years, and people accepted it. No gum. But you will not like this, Jenny. If a person was caught selling gum, they would be fined up to $100,000. And yes, the law, and the fine especially, made a huge difference. I mean, even though chewing gum is no longer banned in Singapore today, you're unlikely to see anyone there doing this in public.
I doubt it was the law or the huge fine that made the difference. I prefer to think of humans as free beings who can make choices about their behavior. In fact, there is something better than laws called a nudge, which is when choices are presented in a way that encourages better actions rather than forcing particular options on people. Like those signs that say, "Thank you for recycling your shopping bags."
Oops, sorry, Jenny. I need to answer this.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Hi, Jenny. Wow, lots of notes right there.
Yeah, I'm preparing for a speech, but I'm still brainstorming for ideas.
Let's see. What's the topic? Maybe I can help.
That would be great. The topic is still not final, but I'm thinking about laws and if they are necessary at all.
Interesting. But we need laws, Jenny, to set boundaries. Don't you think so?
Well, yes and no. We do need laws for complex matters, but humans shouldn't need laws for things that are common sense. That's what makes us human.
Nah. I think you're overestimating what humans can control using logic. We need laws for all matters. This is what makes us civilized.
If that is true, why hasn't the law stopped robberies? So laws on simple things would just be useless.
Well, laws for simple things would work as pointers for behavior. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong is that once there's a law for something silly, it's bound to be broken.
There's some truth in what you're saying, actually. Some people are tempted to do bizarre things just to break the law. Oh, hang on a minute. Let me check this message.
I think I'm going to be on your side, Richard. We do need laws for some people's behavior, like to stop you from checking your phone messages during a conversation.
Sorry. Back to your speech. I think humans need pointers. Think of something as silly as chewing gum. Do people know the mess it causes?
Sure they do.
Of course they do, but there's gum all over the place. So would you say we need a law to stop this?
Are you kidding? Is that even possible? I mean, would a law really make a difference?
Oh, yes. In Singapore, there was a ban on chewing gum for over 30 years, and people accepted it. No gum. But you will not like this, Jenny. If a person was caught selling gum, they would be fined up to $100,000. And yes, the law, and the fine especially, made a huge difference. I mean, even though chewing gum is no longer banned in Singapore today, you're unlikely to see anyone there doing this in public.
I doubt it was the law or the huge fine that made the difference. I prefer to think of humans as free beings who can make choices about their behavior. In fact, there is something better than laws called a nudge, which is when choices are presented in a way that encourages better actions rather than forcing particular options on people. Like those signs that say, "Thank you for recycling your shopping bags."
Oops, sorry, Jenny. I need to answer this.
You now have 2 minutes, 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text B. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear part of an induction program for new members of a health organization.
All right, everyone. This induction program will start by giving you an overview of the history of hygiene. This might sound odd, but soon you'll see how this is important for your tasks in our campaigns to fight disease. So let me start with the word hygiene, which actually comes from the Greek goddess named Hygieia. She was the goddess of health, and this already shows the link between hygiene and health since ancient times. Similarly, many ancient Egyptian paintings from around 6,000 years ago show how important washing and cleanliness was for them. We even have evidence that breath mints were used then. Amazing, isn't it? And hygiene for people in religious roles then was even more rigorous. They washed several times a day, and they believed shaving their heads in particular would prevent infections. In fact, throughout human history, you can see a link between hygienic practices and religions. Hygiene is a form of purification. For example, in some religions, worshippers have to wash immediately before performing rituals. Also, entering some holy places requires the application of certain oils as a sign of devotion, as well as spices for their distinct odor. These slides show pictures of some artifacts and objects related to our topic. Take a look. As you have seen, many societies were hygienic long before the discovery of the germ theory in the mid-19th century. So, although people didn't know why hygiene was linked to being healthy, they still responded to disease with hygienic practices. But how did people make this link? Well, some researchers believe that people with no access to formal education respond to diseases with an innate sense of disgust, rather than understanding the science or logic behind it. As such, disgust is believed to have been the way that humans avoided the spread of disease, long before science explained it. But why does it matter whether hygienic behavior is driven by human instinct or science? To start, having this understanding helps health organizations like us to devise strategies that will work most effectively in different countries. Often, different religions and cultures within a country will also require different strategies. For example, you will soon be going to these places shown on this slide, which are some of the poorest areas in the world. Here, annually, approximately 2 million children lose their lives from infectious diseases. Most people in these communities have hardly any access to education, so flyers that focus on science and logic would have no effect. The best strategy would be to trigger a sense of disgust. For example, our last campaign used images to show how quickly contamination can be passed from hand to food to the body. This increased hand washing before meals by 41%. So, we've looked at the history of hygiene and one way to fight diseases. After lunch, we'll look at how science contributes to disease prevention.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
All right, everyone. This induction program will start by giving you an overview of the history of hygiene. This might sound odd, but soon you'll see how this is important for your tasks in our campaigns to fight disease. So let me start with the word hygiene, which actually comes from the Greek goddess named Hygieia. She was the goddess of health, and this already shows the link between hygiene and health since ancient times. Similarly, many ancient Egyptian paintings from around 6,000 years ago show how important washing and cleanliness was for them. We even have evidence that breath mints were used then. Amazing, isn't it? And hygiene for people in religious roles then was even more rigorous. They washed several times a day, and they believed shaving their heads in particular would prevent infections. In fact, throughout human history, you can see a link between hygienic practices and religions. Hygiene is a form of purification. For example, in some religions, worshippers have to wash immediately before performing rituals. Also, entering some holy places requires the application of certain oils as a sign of devotion, as well as spices for their distinct odor. These slides show pictures of some artifacts and objects related to our topic. Take a look. As you have seen, many societies were hygienic long before the discovery of the germ theory in the mid-19th century. So, although people didn't know why hygiene was linked to being healthy, they still responded to disease with hygienic practices. But how did people make this link? Well, some researchers believe that people with no access to formal education respond to diseases with an innate sense of disgust, rather than understanding the science or logic behind it. As such, disgust is believed to have been the way that humans avoided the spread of disease, long before science explained it. But why does it matter whether hygienic behavior is driven by human instinct or science? To start, having this understanding helps health organizations like us to devise strategies that will work most effectively in different countries. Often, different religions and cultures within a country will also require different strategies. For example, you will soon be going to these places shown on this slide, which are some of the poorest areas in the world. Here, annually, approximately 2 million children lose their lives from infectious diseases. Most people in these communities have hardly any access to education, so flyers that focus on science and logic would have no effect. The best strategy would be to trigger a sense of disgust. For example, our last campaign used images to show how quickly contamination can be passed from hand to food to the body. This increased hand washing before meals by 41%. So, we've looked at the history of hygiene and one way to fight diseases. After lunch, we'll look at how science contributes to disease prevention.
You now have 2 minutes 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text C. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a radio presenter review a talk by Peter Alfandari on the idea of the world becoming a global village.
Good afternoon and welcome to our programme. Today, I will be reviewing a talk on the idea of the global village. When I received the topic for this episode, I was rather concerned that I would be repeating the typical concept of how technology is making the world a small village, which wouldn't be very interesting. Luckily, I came across Peter Alfandari's talk, which he calls The Myth of Globalization. Now,
Alfandari does not deny the superficial meaning of the global village. I mean, who could? Digital communication is so easily accessible, and English is used as a common language in all aspects of life. But what Alfandari argues is that the term global village has created a widespread illusion that people all over the world communicate in a similar way, which we do not. Alfandari, interestingly, points out that the meaning of most English words used in most exchanges are familiar to the people involved. However, as we communicate, what we hear is filtered through our own cultural backgrounds, so as a result, we interpret the message in our own subjective way. And this leads to miscommunication, even when we are listening closely. In his talk, Alfandari gives an example from his own life where cultural differences caused confusion. As part of his job, he had to negotiate deals with a Japanese company. The staff he communicated with spoke English fluently. He finished the meeting with a sense of pride, thinking that they agreed to all the points they'd discussed. To his shock, he later learned that every time they said yes during the negotiation, this only meant that they'd heard him and not that they agreed. A few more meetings had to be held later to negotiate the deal, and since then, he says that there was a shift in how he approached his clients. It's time for a quick break. More on Alfandari's talk when we return. Welcome back. Now, back with Alfandari's myth of a global village. One might find it surprising to learn that this sort of cross-cultural communication issue can happen even between native speakers in English-speaking countries. Alfandari's experience in New York City is a great example. He got into a taxi and spoke in his polite, apologetic English. "Do you think you could possibly take me to the center of the town?" The American driver seemed puzzled and answered, "Well, do you want to go or don't you want to go?" in a friendly but frustrated tone. Alfandari and the driver communicated using the same language, but they still suffered what I can only conclude as culture shock. And, of course, there are other cross-cultural issues to consider. Alfandari raises the idea of punctuality, for example. In monochronic cultures, one is required to be on time and tasks have to be performed as scheduled in the agenda. On the other hand, in polychronic cultures, the sense of time is rather blurry and so, being late for meetings, even crucial business ones, is not the end of the world. So, if we want to communicate successfully, we need to learn about our own cultures as well as other cultures. Alfandari suggests that this will only happen when cultural intelligence is introduced in education systems at all levels. As we develop this skill, we will learn techniques to communicate effectively. So, that's it for today's episode. Join me next week when I will be reviewing another popular talk.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Good afternoon and welcome to our program. Today, I will be reviewing a talk on the idea of the global village. When I received the topic for this episode, I was rather concerned that I would be repeating the typical concept of how technology is making the world a small village, which wouldn't be very interesting. Luckily, I came across Peter Alfandari's talk, which he calls The Myth of Globalization. Now, Alfandari does not deny the superficial meaning of the global village. I mean, who could? Digital communication is so easily accessible, and English is used as a common language in all aspects of life. But what Alfandari argues is that the term global village has created a widespread illusion that people all over the world communicate in a similar way, which we do not. Alfandari, interestingly, points out that the meaning of most English words used in most exchanges are familiar to the people involved. However, as we communicate, what we hear is filtered through our own cultural backgrounds, so as a result, we interpret the message in our own subjective way. And this leads to miscommunication, even when we are listening closely. In his talk, Alfandari gives an example from his own life where cultural differences caused confusion. As part of his job, he had to negotiate deals with a Japanese company. The staff he communicated with spoke English fluently. He finished the meeting with a sense of pride, thinking that they agreed to all the points they'd discussed. To his shock, he later learned that every time they said yes during the negotiation, this only meant that they'd heard him and not that they agreed. A few more meetings had to be held later to negotiate the deal, and since then, he says that there was a shift in how he approached his clients. It's time for a quick break. More on Alfandari's talk when we return. Welcome back. Now, back with Alfandari's myth of a global village. One might find it surprising to learn that this sort of cross-cultural communication issue can happen even between native speakers in English-speaking countries. Alfandari's experience in New York City is a great example. He got into a taxi and spoke in his polite, apologetic English. "Do you think you could possibly take me to the center of the town?" The American driver seemed puzzled and answered, "Well, do you want to go or don't you want to go?" in a friendly but frustrated tone. Alfandari and the driver communicated using the same language, but they still suffered what I can only conclude as culture shock. And, of course, there are other cross-cultural issues to consider. Alfandari raises the idea of punctuality, for example. In monochronic cultures, one is required to be on time and tasks have to be performed as scheduled in the agenda. On the other hand, in polychronic cultures, the sense of time is rather blurry and so, being late for meetings, even crucial business ones, is not the end of the world. So, if we want to communicate successfully, we need to learn about our own cultures as well as other cultures. Alfandari suggests that this will only happen when cultural intelligence is introduced in education systems at all levels. As we develop this skill, we will learn techniques to communicate effectively. So, that's it for today's episode. Join me next week when I will be reviewing another popular talk.
You now have the rest of the time to finish answering the questions.